Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 28th of December, the year 2011. Jeff Pound with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll find out about live music on New Year's Eve with guests Kari Groban and Tom Loker, and Jeffrey Clow will be here to highlight Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month activities in Eagle Crest this January. That right is Almanac Music More, and also here we broadcast of Hank Lanford's Bird Note, because in case you got a chance to miss it yesterday, you'll be able to hear it today. That's later on in the show on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like there's a winter weather advisory until midnight, still in existing until midnight. Forecast for tonight, snow except rain south of Taco Inlet in the evening. And forecast for Thursday, snow showers.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The nomination of a Native American attorney to become a federal judge appears to be dead. As KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports, the request didn't have support of key U.S. senators.
Oklahoma U.S. Senators Tom Coburn and Jim Inhofe were both critical of the nomination of Assistant U.S. Attorney Arvo Mekkonen to become a new federal judge in eastern Oklahoma as soon as the announcement was made. If his nomination had been approved, Mekkonen, a member of the Kiowa tribe, would have been one of only three known Native Americans to ever serve as a U.S. district judge. But now that the nomination has been officially sent back to the White House, one member of Oklahoma's congressional delegation is hoping the Obama administration will work more closely with the legislative branch to make the next appointment. Congressman Dan Boren says it was important for the president to back a Native American nominee, and the administration could possibly find another candidate with a background in Indian country. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
A national panel on First Nations education has wrapped up after touring Canada for 2.5 months. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, difficulties and success stories were discussed.
The panel is a joint initiative of the federal government's Department of Aboriginal Affairs and the Assembly of First Nations. It traveled to every region of Canada and heard from First Nations leaders, educators, elders, parents, and students. And for the panel, the goals were not simply to secure more money for school supplies, but if necessary, to determine if new legislation is needed to improve education for Aboriginal children. Scott Haldane is the head of the panel.
There have been a lot of disappointments over many years, and there's been a lot of bad policy. But I think the stars are aligned differently than they've been before.
More than half of First Nations people in Canada are under 25, and about 350,000 are under 14. Yet fewer than half of First Nations students on and off reserve graduate from high school, compared to more than 80% of other young Canadians. Some experts say the key is First Nations control over education and stable funding from Ottawa. The panel will deliver its recommendations to the federal minister and national chief by the end of the week. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Elders and youth from across Alaska spend some days together each year to exchange knowledge, language, and tradition. The 28th annual Elders and Youth Conference is hosted by First Alaskans Institute. Denise Morris, president and CEO of First Alaskans, says it's important for elders and youth to connect in one place, especially with the demographics in the state.
Unfortunately, in some communities, we have a really large young population, youth population within the Alaska Native community, but unfortunately, we don't have many elders.
Youth expressed some of their thoughts about the event, which addressed issues like leadership, education, health, and wellness.
It felt better to learn more about my Native cultures and their languages.
I like how they had workshops because you can kind of pick and choose. And I went to the teen violence and some of the suicide things, and it's really sad how Natives are kind of destroying, like the youth is destroying our culture by suicide and drugs and alcohol, because that's not respecting our ancestors. And I learned that we kind of have a lot of anger inside of us because of what happened to us long ago, but we can make a difference and stop that.
I learned a lot about my elders and how they grew up when they were my age. I learned that back then, like, most villages didn't have schools, and not everybody, like, they didn't have skiffs or, like, boats and stuff. They didn't have snow machines or four-wheelers. If anybody wanted to, anywhere, they would go with a kayak or a canoe. And most everybody had, like, a dog team to get places or to wherever they needed.
More than 1,000 people participated in the event this fall in Anchorage. During this month in 2007, the Ontario government announced it was returning the Ipperwash Provincial Park to the Kettle and Stony Point First Nation. The Canadian government took the land to build a military training camp during World War II. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
National Native News is made possible with support from Days Inn of Anchorage. Wake up with the sun on the web at daysinalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guests are Tom Loker and Carrie Groven here with the group Groven, Loker, and Good, and also the Wrist Rockets here to talk about things going on this New Year's Eve. Carrie and Tom, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having
us, Jeff. Thank you for having us,
yeah. So let's start with Carrie here. First, maybe a big question is, what brought you to Juneau? You seem to have arrived on the scene in a big way, and you're performing.
It was through music. It's kind of romantic that way, but I studied jazz in Dublin, got a scholarship to do a workshop in Boston in Berklee College of Music, which is where I met my future husband, which happened to be from Juneau. So it was because of the music that I came to Juneau, and it was it's been really rewarding coming here and getting a lot of performing opportunities here, much more than I could ever dream of. It's wonderful.
What does jazz mean to you as a singer?
What it means to me?
Mm-hmm.
It's a style of music that kind of tickles your ear a little bit. It kind of can challenge you. It depends on what kind of jazz you're listening to. And to me, it's kind of been a big eye-opener as to many of the possibilities that there is within singing and within music. And I don't know, it's been kind of expanding the horizon quite a bit, which has been exciting.
What's the best way for a vocalist to communicate to the band?
What is the best way to communicate with the band? Having some kind of common understanding of sign, like body language, and having also common vocabulary about the different sections of the song and what you want to do with the beginnings and the endings of the songs, and then kind of being at ease with things not being necessarily perfect, but being able to problem solve on the spot or kind of improvise on the spot.
Tom Loker, you're
very helpful.
I tend to agree. Being able to improvise on the spot is a great asset in jazz because some things don't always go as rehearsed, and you still have to, I think I still have to try and make it sound as though it was intended or close enough so that it does not sound to the audience like a mistake or something that wasn't planned. It sounds more like improv that was successful, that was successfully executed.
Well, and often unforeseen things is more like a musical offer that you can build upon.
Yes.
You know, and actually make something really interesting and cool off of. And yeah, so we are getting to play around with that on this Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing a gig at the TK McGuire at the Prospector Hotel from 6 to 9 on New Year's Eve. So it will be kind of a dinner time performance.
Right, and we've had great successes with jazz vocal at dinner time at TK McGuire's over the last 2.5 years. We look forward to Saturday night 6 to 9 at TK McGuire's and the Prospector. And since bad weather is predicted for Saturday, I want to let all your listeners know that it's the only place in town with covered parking, so they can park a car inside, walk up the stairs, and have dinner and drinks. listening to Kari Groove and sing this wonderful jazz music with, and Clay and I will have the privilege of playing behind her again this coming Saturday.
Tom, you're responsible for bringing into light a number of jazz divas in town.
Yeah. In 2009, I started the Jazz Divas Project with the help of Sammy Baker, who's here some of the year, gone most of the year. And she served as our MC for the first night, and we're coming up on show number 9 here at the Breakwater, 28th of January. It will also extend to the following evening, the 29th of January. So those two nights will be Jazz Divas number 9 and 10, and we happen to, I think we're really privileged to have some of the same great singers return and be with us again for that. Jazz Divas on the 28th will be, I think, 6:30 to 9:30, and then 5 to 8 on Sunday the 29th. The reason we're doing it two nights in a row is the Breakwater is a little bit smaller, and we want everyone to be able to have an opportunity to come hear us there.
And it gets pretty crowded anyway.
Yeah, it has been in the past. People sure seem to like it. And I've always believed that vocal jazz is some of the most accessible for listeners because it has a lyric which makes the song just a little more familiar, a little more available to the listener, especially in a dinner setting.
And talk where, a little bit, go ahead.
Where there's other things going on, table conversation and, you know, eating and drinking. So,
does that ever bug you as a musician, the fact that people aren't listening to you 100%?
No, not anymore. No, and I've played mostly hotel restaurants, dinner time in the years I've played, and I've grown accustomed to that, that it's as much atmosphere as it is entertainment for a lot of the patrons who come.
Let's say you want to catch their attention. Do you have any secrets for you to sing?
Like, as a piano player, tell the singer to get their attention. That's one good way, because she's the one with the microphone. Yeah. So, but I think Saturday night will be great fun for all the people who come. Last year it was packed, so I strongly advise your listeners who want to come to please make a reservation for a table. 586-3737 is the telephone number to call. And we begin at 6, so if they're full at 6, try for a later table. We'll be going pretty late. We'll finish at 9, so even if they can't get in right at the beginning, there will still be opportunities to come and hear Kari sing Saturday night at the Prospector.
Tom, you're the piano player, and Kari, you are the singer, and you have a drummer, Clay Good, as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And Clay Good, I know a lot of people know him from the Juden Douglas High School. And he's just a really cool, good guy. And as a drummer, he's just wonderfully tasty in what he's playing. He has a lot of, rhythmical nuances, and it makes the whole experience, just yummy. You know,
never
it feels
too
good.
Loud. Very sensitive player, never too loud, and I've had the privilege of playing with Clay now for, I guess, nearly 28 years, now that I think about it, and I've known him since school days, so he's a little older than me, though.
Are you sure?
A pleasure to work with, and so is Tom Locher.
Thank you.
Just, I think it is a specific art form to be able to accompany a soloist or a singer sometimes, and having that kind of sensibility or that kind of ear, being able to adjust and also be able to not leave you hanging to dry, you know, if something are not going completely after plan, like Tom Locher will be there right away and help you in some musical way, or will communicate about how are we getting out of this, you know. And it always works out really smoothly in the end.
Guitarists can break a string, a vocalist can get laryngitis. Tom, what's the worst thing that can happen to a piano player on stage?
Oh, lose your place. That's one of my fears, is I'm going to lose my place and play the wrong place in the song. But I'd say, as far as external things, is if you can't hear, or if the others can't hear the piano and it has to be turned up, or if the piano's too loud, it has to be turned down. So good to have a good volume that everyone can hear.
Do you prefer playing with an? Do you play, prefer playing? Excuse me, I'll start that again. Do you prefer performing with acoustic piano or electric piano?
I like both, but in the performance we're going to do Saturday night, I'll be playing actually two instruments, bass with my left hand, keyboard bass, and piano with my right hand. So for that, you need the support of electronics. So
and two brains.
Yeah, I don't know about two brains, but a lot of practice and the ability to make it sound as though there are two instruments there convincingly. Yeah.
What songs are you going to be singing on Saturday night at the Prospector?
I'm going to do some classics, some good old jazz standards. I'm going to do some more contemporary songs, and we've been working on a Feist song recently, and Suzanne Vega, that is kind of appropriate for that kind of night, and I'll definitely do a handful of songs in Swedish, not Norwegian for some reason. I know the Swedish jazz singers, I really love those, so I'll do those in Swedish. I am from Norway originally, which is where my accent is from.
So TK McGuire is from 6 till 9 p.m. Reservations are encouraged by calling 586-3737.
That's right. And I want everyone to know that we'll have a lot of the American Songbook and jazz standards well represented on the song list. Carr's interpretation of those often breathe new life into old standards, particularly some of the Swedish lyrics on some of these familiar melodies of American Songbook jazz standards. So,
and after that, you could put on your raincoat and go down to the next event, the KXLL event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just figured out, like, I have the whole New Year's Eve day and night just totally planned out for everybody. First, I go to the Prospector and listen to TK McGuire and listen to Tom Loker, Clay Good, and myself do the jazz thing and eat dinner, so that's taken care of. And then go down to the wharf, the whole, which is going to be closed off entirely for the KXLL party, and Kari Groven and the Wrist Rockets, which is a band that I'm also singing in, will be playing for dance and festivities from 9 till midnight.
It's going to be in the ballroom?
Yes, I believe so, yes. And there's like a $5 cover charge as a fundraiser for KXLL. And then after that, after midnight, File Jerks will provide the music with special guest Drunk Kunkel. So, yeah, that's what you should, what everybody should do. No, we should all spread out. But but you can totally follow me the whole day if you like.
Start out with dinner and drinks at the Prospector, and then follow Kari down to the Hangar Ballroom at Merchants Wharf for the KXLL fundraiser.
Who's in the Wrist Rockets?
Who are in the Wrist Rockets? That is my husband Jason Caputo on electric guitar. He's kind of a very strong funk blues rock and roll background, but he's
great.
And a little bit of a punk tinge, I think. And he would play anything that grooves, basically. That makes you like your feet move.
Tom, have you ever been accused of having a funk edge?
Yes. Only when I play with Jason.
Yeah. And then it's Dale McFarlane on drums. He's also kind of hard rocking guy, lots of energy. And Chris Frary, who is from Juneau, I think.
Yes.
On bass, just solid, wonderful to play with. And Mike Busey on trombone, which is our wild card in a way. But it just provides this like wonderful edge to what we're doing. Is really nice.
And he's a good singer, too.
He's a good singer, kind of edgy a little bit.
Yeah, that funk edge.
Yeah.
I love to go listen to the Wrist Rockets. So.
He does some reggae things, and it's fun.
So you define Wrist Rockets music as music that has a groove to dance to?
Yeah. I think that is kind of our, what's it called, common denominator? Or that what is common to our the different songs that we play, because they're all kinds of genres really, but
I tell people that the Wrist Rockets are everything you'd ever want in a bar band, and that rhythm section, Frary and McFarland, have some fire. They're great to dance to. So.
Yeah.
It's your Saturday night all planned out for you, thanks to Corey and Tom here. And
yeah.
Their compatriots.
We look forward to having everybody come down to the Prospector and have dinner, drinks, and listen to Kari and me and Clay. I know the chef at the Prospector, John, has been working with the management there to come up with some special creations for New Year's Eve, so people will have lots of things to choose from and a special menu as well. So.
All right, Tom and Kari, thank you very much for coming down.
Thanks for having us.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask. Anything you'd like to add?
I think it's going to be a fun night. I'm looking forward to it.
I know it is. It'll be a great way to ring in 2012 here in Little Juneau with some live music. So,
well, thank you for coming by.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 28th of December, 2011. It was on this date in 1065 Westminster Abbey was consecrated in London. There had been a monastery there in the late 8th century, and in 1040 King Edward the Confessor ordered construction of a new stone church. By the time it was consecrated, 25 years later, he was too ill to attend. He died a few weeks later, and he was buried in front of the high altar. It's the birthday of the man who gave us Spider-Man, Stan Lee, in 1922, New York City, born Stanley Lieber. Spider-Man was a teenager bitten by a radioactive spider and becomes a crime-fighting superhero. Stan Lee, who also helped create the Incredible Hulk, Iron Man, and the X-Men, superheroes who wore capes and tights and yet suffered from very human fears and insecurities. He got a job at Timely Comics. He got to write some text for a Captain America comic, and he decided to use the name Stan Lee. He said, "I felt someday I'd write the great American novel, and I didn't want to use my real name on these silly little comics." He became editor of Timely Comics just before his 19th birthday, scripted, supervised the art direction of all the superhero comics, gave the artists a story synopsis, a page count. They drew the panels. He went in later to pencil in the speech bubbles. It was on this date, 1612, Galileo first observed the planet Neptune, the eighth planet from the sun. He was studying the moons of Jupiter and saw another bright object that he first took to be a star, later noticed that it moved relative to other celestial bodies, and he kept track of its progress in his journal. It's the birthday of humorist Sam Levinson, 1911, born, raised in Brooklyn, who said, "You must learn from the mistakes of others. You can't possibly live long enough to make all of them yourself." And it was on this day in 1895 that Auguste and Louis Lumiere had the first commercial movie screening at the Grand Café in Paris. An audience paid to watch the brothers' film, Workers Leaving the Lumiere Factory. 46 seconds long, a single shot, a static camera, the factory gates opening up at the end of the day's work, and about 100 workers pouring through them, some walking, some on bicycle. Here's a poem for today by Lewis Jenkins entitled Old Friends. There's a game we play, not a game exactly, a sort of call and response. It's one of the pleasures of living for a long time in a fairly small place. You know, they lived over by Plett's Grocery. Where that bank is now? That's right. Plett's. I'd almost forgotten. Do you remember where Ward's was? Didn't they tear it down to build the Holiday Mall? Yeah. I remember. The Holiday Mall. It works for people, too. Remember the guy who came to all the art exhibit openings, the guy with the hat? Yeah, he came for the free food and drinks. Right. And there was the guy with the pipe and the tweed jacket who always said hello to everyone because he wasn't sure who he actually knew. Oh, yeah. It's like the words to an old song, la la la, some of which you remember. And after I have gone, someone will say, "Oh, him! I thought he was still around. I used to see him everywhere, only all this time I thought he was someone else." Old Friends, a poem by Lewis Jenkins, from Sea Smoke, published by Holy Cow Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith and written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Many people are fascinated with and truly love wild animals. Many dream of the day when they might just get a glimpse of a wild wolf, a bear, a wolverine, or a lynx. Steve Krushel has been fortunate enough to have been filming them for decades, and now he has opened a wildlife park at his home in Haines, Alaska, so he can share with others an up-close view of some of nature's most awe-inspiring animals.
I was born and raised in rural Minnesota. Growing up, though, it was very wild and kind of remote. But over the years, that remoteness and that wilderness essence started to evaporate. And now it's become a very measured and developed area with, you know, a lot of suburban developments and subdivisions and so on. So it lost that wildness, as I think most of the lower 48. Here at the Wildlife Center in Southeast Alaska, we have animals that are indigenous to this part of Alaska. So we've got coyotes, red fox, wolves, wolverines, pine martens, porcupines, lynx. We also have animals here that aren't found in Southeast Alaska, but they're indigenous to Alaska, like reindeer and Arctic foxes. They're part of the North Country, but not exactly found precisely in this area. And I think that a lot of visitors find that intriguing, too, that when they come here, their imaginations then can turn to, when they look at these endless mountains and vast valleys, that, oh yes, the pine marten is somewhere down in those trees, you know, hunting right now for a red-backed bull or some such thing. Years ago, got involved with wildlife cinematography, worked on a PBS series, a number of different PBS series, National Geographic, Discovery Channel, and all these different wildlife shows, Nature, Wild America. And I traveled all over the United States and got a very good view of North America, not only the United States, but Canada as well. And I could pretty much get an idea of where the truly wild places are. And, of course, repeatedly I'd always be going north. When I was just a kid, 12, 13 years old, I was fortunate enough to happen across some orphaned river otters. And I worked with these river otters, and they became my friends. Because I lived in a rural area, I wasn't able to, you know, interact with a lot of other kids. So these river otters sort of supplanted that. The river otters, I bottle raised them, so they pretty much only knew human beings. And so they followed me around, you know, wherever I went, and we had a large farm and lots of acreage, and the otters would follow me down to the creek and swim and come back when I called them, and it was really fun. They're just like clowns. They really are called clowns of the wild. Through the course of time, photographers would come and want to take pictures, and then it was motion picture work. And eventually, it came to the point where there was a movie being made in Alaska called Never Cry Wolf. It was a Disney film back in 1981. I worked on that, taking care of the wolves. And I watched how filmmaking was done, and I thought to myself, boy, they're rolling a lot of film on that wolf before he starts to go from point A to point B. And I just thought that I could do the same thing. After the movie was done, I bought a camera and started to do filming on my own, just on speculation that someone would buy it. I filmed a sequence of a short-tailed weasel in the wintertime hunting, and eventually this weasel caught a chickadee. I filmed that on about 200 feet of 16-millimeter film. I sent it to various places, and eventually it was purchased for a film about weasels. And I got $1,500. It was 30 seconds long. And then I was able to finance more of this effort of shooting wildlife. And it just one thing led to another, and pretty soon I was making wildlife shows. My parents very much loved nature, and my grandparents. I grew up on a farm where my dad's parents also lived. In those days, of course, they were almost living subsistence-wise when my dad was growing up. And so they would pick berries, they would go fishing, they would hunt, and all of these things. So they handed down to me their love of nature, what they've learned, and how to survive on very little and live in harmony with nature. And I'm forever grateful for that. I mean, that's a priceless gift. I think that we need to instill that in our children now, especially now, because wild places are very rapidly vanishing. And if our children now can realize and really understand the places that are still left, maybe we have a chance of keeping these wild places for generations to come. My son Garrett, he's 12 years old. He lives with me here in our log cabin and helps with the Wildlife Center. Garrett, he's quite an amazing kid to me. I just am moved every day with his love and compassion and passion for animals and wild places. He can identify a lot of different kinds of birds, and he understands the different plants that are around here, can identify them. He likes to pick berries. He likes to go fishing. Garrett very much enjoys watching me film, and now he has a video camera, and I bought him a tripod, and I said, Garrett, whatever you find interesting, go ahead and shoot. He came up with a very creative idea about setting up this little pole with a long string with a little piece of meat attached to the end of the string. It was about 2 feet long. He thought that ravens would be smart enough to figure out how to get that little piece of meat dangling on the string. Sure enough, he videotaped a raven landing on this piece of wood, like a branch, and the raven looked down at that piece of meat, and he pulled up the string inch by inch and stepped on the slack with his foot and got the bait. The string was about 2.5-3 feet long, and he had the videotape to prove that the raven did that. So Garrett has definitely gotten a great bit of reward now already from going out with his camera and shooting nature. I've raised wolverines for about 20 years now. First ones were born in captivity, and they were put on a milk type of solution, and they grew very well and were very affectionate, and got a great deal of insight about wolverines through that experience. And being a filmmaker, I did some film work with them. That film work got out into the public, broadcast on television, which spawned a whole spate of programs about wolverines, which was enormously rewarding for me, because for many years you didn't see footage of wolverines. I mean, it just didn't exist. They're very hard to film. What we learned was mostly from books and a few biologists that had the stick-to-itiveness to go out and try to study them. But a lot of our information about wolverines, there were misconceptions. It wasn't correct. That still persists to this day, of course, because it makes for good storytelling. A lot of it is partly true, but a lot of it is kind of embellished, too. Wolverines do very interesting things in the game of survival. They will spring traps, you know, on a trap line, and they have done that. They continue to do that and steal the bait and all that, and they figure things out, and they're very strong. And if they get caught in a leg hole trap, for example, themselves, and they're very strong, they can pull out. Then after that point, they will know how to spring the trap without getting caught and take the bait. That intelligence extends to them then relating a man with food in remote areas. They'll break into a cabin. I mean, they'll bust through a window or rip open a door and get in and mess up the cabin and eat the food, whatever they can find, and drag it off. They live a long time, too. They can live up to 25 years in captivity. In the wild, they normally don't live nearly that long because of food availability and so on. But one of the things that people probably don't know about the wolverine is that they're extremely playful, almost as playful as their cousin the river otter. Of course, they've got this reputation of being very fierce and mean, but that's only when their life is in danger. Otherwise, they're one of the most playful animals in the animal kingdom. They also have incredible jaw strength. Wolverines have, in their jaws, 2,300 pounds of pressure per square inch. No other animal in the world has that kind of jaw strength except the spotted hyena. Knock on wood, all these years I have never gotten injured by the animals purposely. The animals, of course, I get scratched, I get bloody noses and so on, and everything else from the animals, but never out of anger or meanness from the animals. And if that was the case, and I was in the line of fire from that, I could be seriously damaged. I mean, really. A wolf has incredible jaw strength, for example. 1,500 pounds of pressure per square inch. Enough strength to snap the bone of a moose, for example. Well, if they were mad and they bit my arm, they could break my arm or my shoulder or whatever. They could kill a person. There is that danger. But when we're filming animals in the wild, even for still photography, how do we keep the animals from running off? Well, the idea is before you even take this animal out in the woods, or out in the beautiful scenic setting in these mountains to film, you have such a strong relationship with that animal that you know that the bond is so powerful that wherever you go, it will go. You don't even need food to entice it. It comes because you have that bond. You have that connection with that creature. We then are able, when you work with an animal that intensively, that you have that confidence. You can work now with, I don't care if it's a mouse, a weasel, a wolf, a coyote, a lynx, whatever. All of these animals will respond and come to you when you call them. And I've done that for years and years now, and it works marvelously. I don't use any electric fences or any artificial means of attracting them. They come because you have that bond. I truly feel that there is a higher vibration that you have with an animal when you work so closely with it. They sense that, and so you can communicate with that animal, and I do on a daily basis without saying anything, just by being there with them. They know what's going on. And that really has a profound effect on me. I think that for many of us, we don't realize the intelligence and the senses, the incredible, powerful senses that wild creatures have, and how they can understand and feel and think. We call them dumb animals, but they're far from being unintelligent. Animals can read your intent without you saying anything, without you even moving, just by being near them. They can almost read your mind. You know what's interesting, for example, about the intelligence and the information and the communication abilities of animals is that it's said that a raven, in one song that they sing, they can communicate in 15 seconds more information than the entire Holy Bible. Same goes for whales. Same goes for many birds in their songs, in their courtship songs. And interestingly, all the different sounds and songs that the birds and mammals have, they're all at different frequencies, so no bird is stepping on the frequency level of another bird. So they're all in a complete harmonious symphony. It's a beautiful orchestra that nature has put out there, in which no creature is stepping on the vibration and the audio level of another creature. The highlight of working and raising wild animals is to see the response in visitors and how they are then given a very interesting, unique insight into our wild creatures that motivates them then to care about not only that creature, but the habitat that they need to survive. And ultimately, of course, that habitat happens to be what we need to survive. It all goes hand in hand. In less than 100 years, the Industrial Revolution, we've eliminated all of this, the wild essence of our world, our rainforest, our earth, I mean, is gasping for its life. How do you relate to children now about these things, these problems that face us with our environment? It's quite a dilemma. It's very difficult. I don't know the answer. I think that society is now on this very destructible path in which we are not keeping in mind sustainability of our environment, of what keeps us going. We're actually eating ourselves out of house and home, and it doesn't have to be that way. What we can do is learn to live in harmony with nature, follow nature's basic laws, and in doing that, we have sustainability. We can live and have a future if we do that. If we don't, there's going to be an end to, I don't know if it's our mankind's journey, or at least a quality of life that is enjoyable. It's quite noticeable when you live in a very pristine area like Alaska, that after a while, even if you spend a few months, and you go down to Minnesota or Montana or Wyoming or places that we thought were really wild, you see a big difference. There isn't really wild there anymore. It's not vast. If you start on a journey, say you're walking, every few miles in most places you're going to run into a road or a building or a power line or something that man has done. Conversely, in the north here, you can go for days, months, without running into anything. It's just endless wilderness. And one of the reasons for that is because these mountains are so incredibly rugged and hard to, you know, get up and over. And so we can't really develop these areas here like we can down south. So the ruggedness, the mountain terrain of the north, as well as the harsh climate, the cold and so on, has been a barrier for development in the north, I think. Without habitat, no animal can survive. For example, a pack of wolves, say 6 or 8 wolves, they need at least 500 square miles of country to live. And if there isn't greater food availability, it can go up to 1,000 or 1,200 square miles of territory. One wolverine needs between 500 and 1,000 square kilometers of territory to thrive, to live and flourish. If we don't have areas like that anymore that are truly wild, what are these animals going to do? They disappear, and that's exactly what they've done in less wild country. The interesting thing about some wildlife, such as coyotes and deer, raccoons, possums, and so on, they are able to adapt to some degree to man's activities, to encroachment. But when they adapt, though, they're perceived as sort of a pest and a problem. Like beavers, you know, they're damming up culverts and flooding roads and so on. All of these are really signs that we have maybe gone too far in certain directions in development, and we have not learned again to perhaps live and harmonize ourselves and our culture with nature. Now, other animals such as wolverines, wolves, grizzly bears, they'll never be able to adapt to human encroachment. And what they do is they just disappear. They will eventually become extinct. Interesting story in doing wildlife filming was the last couple of years I was involved in a program about Sasquatch, Bigfoot. And, of course, the story goes that, and the idea is that these creatures, whatever they are, probably are finding this part of Alaska as one of their last great hopes to keep hidden from mankind. And I went into this project about Sasquatch. It was a show for, I think it was a Discovery Channel, with a great deal of skepticism. But then we were interviewing scientists and doctors and a lot of researchers that have been following this for years and years. And I have gone away thinking, you know, there is no way to debunk all of this. And there's so much evidence to support the existence of Bigfoot, and I have an open mind that I can't be certain. And I've seen tracks, and I've talked to the experts, forensic scientists, I mean everyone, criminologists, and there's just so much evidence to support the idea of existence of such a creature that it can't be disputed. What's neat is that still, even today, even in this year, we have wild areas left that are still wild enough that could actually keep a creature like this hidden from probing eyes of science. I've talked to some of the locals in this area, and they have had close encounters with Sasquatch. One man saw one drinking at a small pond one time. Another one saw one running past some trees while he was hunting moose. These are credible people. It's hard for me to say, oh, come on, you know, maybe you had a little bit too much of the old John Barleycorn to drink. So it's interesting. And this does go along with all of the evidence that this creature, if it does exist, is going to be in this type of climate and habitat. Many of the predators that could survive the ice age and the changing climate, now probably their biggest challenge is at hand, where we have a vanishing wilderness area and they can't combat that. Mankind now in the last 50 years, actually in the last decade, has created such incredible toxins that don't deteriorate, that are so deadly, that are so easily spread and have done so via the air all around the world, that these kind of nightmarish forces that we've created are so paramount, so great, that I don't think any of these creatures that survived the Ice Age can deal with. And including us, as we're finding out. Cancer rates, for example, for human beings in the late 1940s were 1 in 16. But today, as of this year, it's 1 in 2. Our bodies are the alarm clocks to the toxicity of our environment, to the degradation of our environment. When I was a child and I first was exposed to all of the romance and story and adventure of Alaska, the true Alaskan, how I would have defined it then, was one who lived in harmony with nature, who lived off the land, who understood the birds and the mammals and all the wild creatures that were here. Now we have, I think, lost somewhat of the essence of those true Alaskans. We have immigrated to this part of the world, and we have brought along our toasters and our microwave ovens and our color TVs. So that essence of what makes a true Alaskan, I think, is somewhat diluted. Although there are a lot of tenacious people out there that still live in the bush and live off the land, they're truly tasting of the real Alaskan experience yet. So they're out there. But what makes a true Alaskan, I think, is one who lives in harmony with nature.
A Portrait of Alaskan, Steve Kosher, was produced by Edward and Melinda May from their series Alaskan Life Portraits. Time is 3:45 and you are tuned to KTO News in Juneau. And our next guest on the Juneau afternoon is Jeffrey Cloud calling from EagleQuest. Jeffrey, thank you for being on the air with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeff.
So what was it like today up there in the mountain?
Oh, it's an amazing winter wonderland up here, Jeff. We've gotten good 3 to 4 inches of snow up here today, and it's still snowing. And everybody's just got big grins on their face and smiles and just having a great time up here.
What's the difference in skiing in powder like you have now versus when the slopes have been groomed more?
I like it more. I get more of a giggle out of skiing powder than the groomed slopes, but it can be a little bit more work. It just all depends on what kind of powder you have. And right now, with our temperatures being in the 20s, the powder's more light and fluffy, and it's just really fun to ski.
And you're on the air today to talk about Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month, which is in January.
Yes, Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month is January, up and coming. And what that is that's a national effort to try and get everybody out and enjoying skiing and snowboarding. And Eagle Crest is part of that national effort. And so we've got some special promotions and programs that we're doing during the month of January. And just kind of encouraging everyone to take up skiing and snowboarding. And with all of the snow that we have, this is the year to take it up and learn how to ski or snowboard or improve your skills.
I know there's a learning here for snowboards and skiing as well. What is the learning curve like for a novice skier?
Well, what the industry has shown in many studies that they've taken is that 3 times will kind of get you up over that learning curve and get you really enjoying the mountain. And so because of that survey that's been done and that information that we've gathered, we offer what we call our Triple Play Learner's Pack, which is 3 lessons, 3 lower mountain lift tickets, and 3 rentals. And they can be used consecutively for days, Jeff, or you can use them one this weekend and one next weekend and one the following weekend.
Well, what other packages do you have?
Well, we're doing all sorts of specials, and you can find them out on skijuneau.com. One of our great programs that we started last year was what's called the Women's First Tracks, and it's programs just designed just for women and trying to get women up to learn how to ski and snowboard. We're doing the first session is, our first workshop is January 7th, and our next workshop is January 15th. And again, it's just women for women, designed to say, hey, come on up, spend the morning with a friend, and learn how to ski or snowboard.
How do women and men ski differently?
I think men are traditionally probably a little bit stronger. They tend to muscle it through where women want to finesse it a little bit, and those are just very generalizations, but what we found is women like to learn with women, and it's more a social too, and I think women are more nurturing, and they're taking care of everybody and making sure that everybody's lunches are packed and learning how to ski, and what we want to do is give them an opportunity to treat themselves to learning how to ski or snowboard themselves.
How much snow is on the mountain now?
On the mountain now, we've got 60 inches at the Day Lodge, and we have 140 inches at the top of the mountain. That's packed base. And based on our records and everything that we have found, we believe we have the most snow in the country. Jeff?
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And it's just fabulous up here. And to find out everything that we have going on up at Eagle Crest, you can visit skijuneau.com.
All right, Jeff, I'll let you get back to work here. Thank you for being on the air with me today.
All right. Thanks so much, Jeff. Talk to you later.
Time is 3:49. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Yesterday we played Bird Norton, as I knew it was going to be happening, but it was also a pleasant surprise to hear Hank Lanfer, author of Faith of Cranes, a new book that's out in local bookstores. And he was the guest on Bird Norton, and I thought it was such a good idea to play it again that I thought I'd will, and I can, because I am the boss.
This is Bird Note. In the late 1990s, Julia Parrish of the University of Washington started the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, or COAST.
In COAST, we train people to go out to their local beach and survey it. They're looking for birds that have literally washed in on the last tide. You might think to yourself, well, how many people actually would want to spend time going out looking for bird carcasses? I mean, it's got to be kind of messy and a little bit smelly. I thought maybe we'd get 10, 15, maybe 20 people. But we have almost 700 people in the COAST program now, and they collect data for us every month. I think people do that because they are attached to where they live. So COAST offers people a chance to learn more about the birds, about the natural history, why they're there, when they're there, whether that's something we should be concerned about or not. Information both local and regional empowers people to want to know more and to want to do more. And that, I think, is the essence of citizen science. I think that last century was the century of academic science. And I think that this century is the century of citizen science.
If you've been wanting to volunteer as a citizen scientist, we can help you get started at our website, birdnote.org. Today's show brought to you by the Lufkin Family Foundation.
I apologize, that program about Hank Lanfer aired yesterday, and they updated the program on their website. So if you'd like to tune into that again, you can check out our website, kto.org, and listen to a link for it Juneau afternoon. Yesterday, we played that in its entirety.
Tonight on 360 North, it's the return of Puffin Bay, an Alaska town that time forgot. A strange, mysterious, and wondrous place where miracles can happen. That's at 8. Followed at 9:30 by Alaska History, It's Magic, with Alaska magician Jeff Brown, who teaches young people about their state in a truly enchanted way. With the Miller Center Forum at 10, it's a great night of programming tonight on 360 North. Learn more at 360north.org.
The New Year's Eve Barn Dance is always a fun, sociable way to close out the old year with friends and neighbors. The Taku Gales, Greg McLaughlin, Liz and Leif Saya, will provide lively Celtic and French-Canadian dance tunes, and Tom Paul will teach and call conference square dances from 7:30 to 11 Saturday night at St. Anne's Parish Hall downtown at 5th and Gold. As always, you don't need any experience or a partner. Discounts for students and seniors, free for SOG and JVs. It's the New Year's Eve Barn Dance. For more information, call 463-3214.
Hi, this is Linda Rosenthal inviting you to make New Year's Eve a special one when Judo Jazz and Classics and the Moss Family present Swing in the New Year at the Jack featuring the Thunder Mountain Big Band, a benefit for the 2012 festival. Great dance music, hors d'oeuvres, and a champagne toast. Tickets at jazzandclassics.org, the Jack, Hearthside, and Rainy Retreat Books. Thanks to KRNN, the Baranoff, the Juno Empire, and the Alaskan Brewing Company for their support. Get ready to swing in the new year.
A little bit of the music of the Thunder Mountain Big Band to usher out this program of a Juno afternoon today. You're tuned to KTUO News in Juno. We broadcast 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Miss Davis listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juno, you can also receive KTUO on GCI Cable, Juno on Digital Channel 871. KRN can be heard at Digital Channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. Also online at www.ktuo.org. Tomorrow at 3 on a Juno afternoon, we'll find out about The Movement, a film about adaptive skiing showing next Monday at the Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater. And Nancy DeJourney will give us the rundown on art happenings in the capital city during Arts Up. At Writer's Almanac, Music and More tomorrow at 3 on a Juno afternoon. It's a winter weather advisory until midnight tonight. Snow mixing with rain south of Taku Inlet this evening, then snow showers later on. About 3 to 5 inches of snow expected tonight. Thursday, about snow showers, about 1 to 3 inches expected. High temperatures around 32 degrees. Forecast for Thursday night, snow showers likely in the evening, then a chance of snow later on. 1 to 2 inches is expected. Friday, mostly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 27 degrees. Coming up next, it's All Things Considered. Thank you very much for tuning in to Juno Afternoon today, and have a pleasant evening. Drive and walk safely, please.